Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line this evening, once again, Dr. Carolyn Dean. And last week we had Dr. Dean on. We were talking about her new book on magnesium. And this evening I wanted to talk about her book, Death by Modern Medicine. Now, as a physician, when I was practicing, you know, I was always very resentful when I heard people talking about deaths from modern medicine, because I believe that most doctors do their best to try to take care of their patients, and every once in a while there is a mistake, and people tragically will die, maybe a surgical error, maybe a mistake in the post-operative management of a case or an intensive care unit, but most doctors are doing the best that they can. But the problem is, as Dr. Dean brings out in her book, is an institutionalized situation where you have gigantic drug companies competing to come out with new drugs that may not be any much different at all than the other drugs on the market. They're sort of Me Too type of drugs, each one being marketed as better than the other ones. But you see, the drug companies have to come up with something that's going to make money, so their stock will go up. And rather than being concerned about coming up with drugs that really will help people, what they want is something, tragically, that they can sell. And Dr. Dean, I thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan. Happy to be back.
Well, we want to go through some of the things that you actually bring out in your book about the way that many of these drugs are actually put onto the market. And you actually talk a little bit about Dr. Marshall Angel, who we've read her book. In fact, we offer her book, What You Should Know About the Drug Companies. And it's really quite an expose of what goes on. Would you like to talk a little bit about what's happening? We've seen this spectacle with Vioxx, and recently why Merck Company lost someone who died of a heart attack after taking Vioxx. What a settlement of $250 million. Of course, it'll never stand. They'll cut that down on the appeal process, but there are going to be many, many millions of dollars that they're going to have to pay out, because they knew this was a dangerous drug, and they knew it was killing people, and it would kill large numbers of people, and they put it on the market anyway. And what's really so very, very interesting is if you read the articles in the paper, and you even watch CBS, they had on 60 Minutes the other night talking about Vioxx, and they said, oh, well, you know, well, we knew that it would double the incidence of heart attack, but it was really very, very minimal. Well, the truth of the matter is, and anybody would like to see Dr. Graham's testimony, that's we have his testimony in one of my newsletters. Dr. Graham worked for the FDA, risked his reputation to tell the American people that the initial 090 study on Vioxx showed a 700% increase, according to Dr. Graham, of the incidence of heart disease. And the next study against a product that they knew increased the incidence of heart disease still showed a 350% increase in heart attack, and they put a lethal drug on the market knowing full well it would kill people. So, Dr. Dean, what's your take on that?
Well, for News with Views, I write a weekly column for that internet site, newswithviews.com. I don't know if you've seen it this week. It's Big Pharma Feeds on Your Pain. That was our original title. Then we changed it to a little bit of a softer title.
Hold that thought, sir, just a moment. Well, I guess this evening, Dr. Carolyn Dean, we're talking about her book, Death by Modern Medicine. Go ahead, pick up the story there, Dr. Dean.
Yes, we retitled the the story. Big Pharma's pain-for-profit industry booming despite the Vioxx verdict. Because what people don't understand is that medicine is a business now for people who are marketing drugs and marketing all kinds of devices. And we came across this article on the internet, the U.S. marketing plan for pain management of drugs and devices. And they're telling us that the pain industry is worth about $70 billion. And that's what it costs annually in missed work days and hospital visits and all the rest of it. But in order to market pain to hospitals and drug companies, they're telling people that they can make $25 billion by getting on the bandwagon. So we talk about the way pain and illness is marketed as a commodity. And then, you know, we go into the facts about pain, that pain and inflammation, they can start, you know, very easily in someone who's just a few pounds overweight. If you're 15 pounds overweight, the extra pressure on your hips and knees and your ankles can create swelling and a bit of fluid buildup, and even a few millimeters of fluid in a joint can cause severe pain. So you think there's a big problem, you go to your doctor, and instead of your doctor giving you the common sense of advice to lose some weight and exercise and don't let your joints rust up, they give you a painkiller. And then there's this vicious cycle where the painkiller, in the case of Vioxx, it's not just that 55,000 people died of a heart attack or a stroke. Hundreds of thousands of people had minor complaints and minor side effects that build up and then were treated with more drugs. So we've got this vicious cycle that people really have to understand, that they have control over their health, and if they start from scratch of looking at, well, I've got a pain, the body is trying to tell me something, let's see what I can change in my diet, in my environment, in my lifestyle, in order to get rid of this symptom. Not go running to a doctor for... Well, we go running to a doctor because we think they're going to help us.
Hold that thought there for just a minute. We'll be right back here. Well, I think that people do go to the doctor because they want to be helped, and I think the doctor wants to help them. But unfortunately, doctors are not trained in nutrition. Certainly, organized medicine has done everything they could through the years to play down the importance of vitamins and minerals. And of course, very seldom is the doctor going to tell you, stop drinking milk. Stop, you know, eating sugar. I mean, these are things that are really going to influence your health. Certainly, the doctor will tell you, you've got to lose weight, but, you know, unless you have some idea of how to go about it, and you're not going to go about it eating the same things that you have, you're going to have to really change your diet and change it largely. And you can lose weight, you know, if you really get onto a veg-and type of diet. But all of the things that they're putting into our foods today, the MSG, the aspartame, and all the prepared foods, if you give an animal MSG or aspartame, they're going to get pathologically obese. They know that. They knew that when they released NutraSweet into our society back in 1981, when Donald Rumsfeld, the president of Cereal Company, actually forced his people into key positions in the FDA, and they overrode all of the various panels of scientists that the FDA had that had been keeping aspartame off the market for 15 years. And suddenly, in our diet, Pepsi, and in our diet Coke, and in our diet drinks, and so many prepared foods that people get, and if you go to the, you begin to look and see what you're getting, you get prepared foods, why they have either MSG in one form or another, or glutamate, or aspartame there, and they all produce pathological obesity.
Yes.
And how often is it, you know, we hear these articles and these programs on television talking about obesity, and they blame it on Colonel Sanders. They blame it on...
No, they don't even. They just, they'll, they ref- they don't even talk about the fast food industry. They say you're not getting enough exercise. And they say it's genetic. They won't even admit that diabetes and obesity is partly caused by sugar, because the sugar industry is so powerful. They'll sue people if they say sugar does anything more than just cause a few cavities. And that's part of our problem as well, because doctors and, well, doctors, they won't stand up and say that sugar is a problem. I've been attacked because I've said sugar is bad for you on national TV. So I know that these lobby groups, these food industry lobby groups, are very powerful. And a doctor who doesn't prescribe drugs and who speaks out against the food industry is at risk of losing their license. And a lot of listeners don't realize that. This is why doctors don't speak out. You have to retire first. In one of my radio shows, I have a radio show every Wednesday morning, we interviewed Dr. Russell Blaylock, and he wrote the book Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills. And he talks about aspartame and MSG, and he's retired now, and I think it's us retired folks who are making all this noise, because if you have a license to lose, then you're not going to put yourself on the line.
And I really think that's so tragic. We find this in dentistry. A dentist who speaks out against mercury fillings, they're going to go after him. A dentist who speaks out against fluoride and the fact that they were destroying the minds of our children with water fluoridation, they're going to go after him. And you wonder, could this really happen in America? Why, that thing wouldn't happen in America. If it did, why, Rush Limbaugh would tell us. Well, Rush Limbaugh, of course, has paid a great deal of money not to reveal the truth, but to conceal it.
Well, look what happened to him. He was addicted to painkillers to the point that he lost his hearing. It's amazing. And actually, the fluoride issue, did you interview Dr. Paul Connett the other day?
No, I didn't. I really, for our listeners out there, Dr. Paul Connett is a professor of chemistry, and his website is fluoridealert.org. That's fluoridealert.org. Let me suggest you go there. If you have not been there and look at the information he puts out, it is truly amazing. All the scientific studies that show that how deadly a poison fluoride is, how deadly a poison hydrofluorosilicic acid that is used in 90% of the cities that fluoridate their water, and the studies that show that if you have hydrofluorosilicic acid in there, which has some fluoride in it, also has some lead, but for some other reason, almost all the children in those areas have a high dangerous level of lead in their bodies, in their bloodstreams, and you're never going to hear that mentioned by the controlled media.
Right. Well, when I spoke to Dr. Connett, he was saying that the benefits of fluoride in studies are that they may help 0.6 of one tooth surface out of 100 tooth surfaces. That's as much as topical or oral use will do. But actually, the Dental Association will say, well, maybe oral doesn't work, but they'll still use topical. And then on the labeling of a toothpaste tube, it'll say toxic if swallowed. And what child doesn't swallow their toothpaste? It's incredible that they allow this to be used. And he was saying that babies who are bottle fed using tap water are getting 100 to 200 times the fluoride that nature intended. So it's gone beyond, as you say, beyond the credibility of people. People just don't believe that such chemicals are being are found in our environment, and why the government won't stop them. Well, I think it's because when you have programs like fluoridation of water, mercury in our dental amalgams and in our vaccines, at the point where they have to admit that they were wrong, they're going to be sued within an inch of their lives. And therefore, they'll never admit that they're wrong.
Well, of course, that may well be a part of it, but I believe that there really are evil and wicked people out there who have no regard for human health really believe there are too many people in the world today, and we'd really be, in many respects, better off if there weren't so many people. In Newburg, New York, where the original study was done on the water fluoridation, at the end of 10 years, they found the incidence of heart disease was doubled in Newburg, New York, and it's still one of the highest in the entire nation today where the water is fluoridated. But they want to tell us, well, we have to fluoridate the water because look how much better the children's teeth are. And yet, at the end of 50 years, there wasn't a bit of difference between the two communities.
And what I'm hearing is in areas where children get too much fluoride, either, you know, in the water, in the toothpaste, and naturally occurring, their teeth become mottled. And in fact, you know, it's doing the opposite. It's damaging the teeth. And certainly making them look unsightly. And the other aspect of fluoridation is when they found that it may help, it perhaps helps in 1 year of life to make the teeth a little harder. And with that bit of evidence, they went on to fluoridate everybody's water. I was astounded to hear that, you know, even the water filter that I've been using, which I thought took out the fluoride, Dr. Connett said that, no, the carbon filters won't do it. You have to use a reverse osmosis type of filter. So people have to look into whether their water supply is fluoridated and then find a treatment that will get rid of it.
Well, I think one of the really tragic situations is that black children in the water areas where they fluoridate the water have far more dental fluorosis than the white children. And if they have dental fluorosis, they also have mental changes. And that is really what's happening. Fluoride impacts on the brain. And the brain of children, they find that, for instance, in China, in the areas where they have fluoridated water, they have no geniuses. The average child loses 10% on the IQ. In the non-fluoridated areas, they do have geniuses, and the children have normal intelligence. And this is exactly what they're doing to our children. But even more unconscionable, it seems that the black is much more affected by fluoride than the white, just as they're much more prone, for instance, to get HIV disease, which I personally believe is a genetically engineered organism. And certainly we know in America today, 65% of the new cases of HIV disease are in blacks. So could there possibly be another agenda behind water fluoridation? And the fact that people are not hearing the truth, they're not hearing about Dr. Paul Connett, who you interviewed, or going to his website, www.fluoridealert.org, fluoridealert.org. Go there. Check the facts, determine if this possibly could be true. And then if it is, of course, help Dr. Dean and myself and Dr. Blaylock and the others who are involved in this battle get the truth out across America before more lives are shattered and more children are lost.
Yes, another doctor that we're interviewing in a few weeks is Dr. Schoenthaler. Have you come across his work?
Oh, no, tell me a little bit about it. The name is somewhat familiar.
Right, Stephen Schoenthaler. For 25 years, he's been doing nutritional work in large groups of children. He did a study in the New York Department of Education in the 80s. I think he had about 800,000 children in this program, and their IQ improved on good nutrition.
Well, I have no question, of course, good nutrition can do a great deal of good. But then, of course, when we're feeding our children products that have lead in them, knowing full well it's going to hurt them. And, of course, that's what's in hydrofluorosilicic acid is lead and arsenic and some fluoride. And why are we giving that to our children? And then, of course, we're giving them the mercury and the vaccines and the dental fillings. And we're giving them aspartame, which impacts on the mind, impacts on the brain. Why would you do something like that? Unintentionally, and how would you conceal it from the American people? We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Carolyn Dean. Her book, Death by Modern Medicine, and we'll tell you a little later if you're interested in how you might get more information about that. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Carolyn Dean, and Dr. Dean is retired at the present time. She has written a book, Death by Modern Medicine. It has a number of chapters. It talks about death by the media, talks about death by modern drugs and procedures, death by modern science, a section on death by modern chemicals. And which one shall we cover? Let's just take one chapter at a time as we go through it. Which one shall we go by?
Oh, good grief. It's your choice.
How about death by modern science? That certainly is an interesting concept. I mean, science supposedly is there, a search for the truth, a search to find out the cause of disease and to cure the disease. But as you point out in your book, unfortunately, when large profits are at stake, and we're talking about billions of dollars for the drug companies and for the stockholders, and I have nothing against making a profit, but when you put a drug on the market that doesn't work, and you know it is not going to work on more than maybe 30% of the people who buy it, and then you put on a massive sales campaign to convince the doctors that this is the greatest thing since the advent of sliced bread, and the doctor begins, of course, trying to convince the patient to take it because the detail man has left him all sorts of women, usually very attractive women, incidentally, has left all sorts of samples there for the doctor to give away for nothing. And the doctor actually believes what the detail people have told him, and the companies lie to the detail people. And you have people taking medicines that really have very little chance of having a good effect. In fact, you point out there that somebody from, what was it, SmithKline, Glaxo, said that the majority of medicines really don't work on people. What was that statement?
Yes, that was, where was that? That was a British vice president.
It was a man named Roses.
Yes, there it is, Alan Roses, worldwide vice president of genetics at GlaxoSmithKline. Now, he admitted that half of the patients taking blockbuster drugs actually benefit from them, you know, just less than half. But he had a reason for doing that. But see, look what he's a vice president of, genetics. Because they know the drugs aren't working, they're trying to divert people into thinking, well, let's do your genetic profile, and oh, then we'll be able to tell you exactly what drug will work for you. So there's a method to that madness, because they're going to start telling us that they're going to do tailor-made drugs, and you know, anything that's a drug, which is patented, which is foreign to the body, you know, synthetic to the body, it's going to have a side effect, even if they try to make it tailor-made to your genes. I don't believe one word of it. They call it pharmacogenomics, applying human genetics to drug development, identifying responders, people who will so-called benefit from the drug. So it's just another selling point. It's another gimmick, I'm afraid. And it keeps diverting us from the real issues of the body needing vitamins and minerals in order to do any chemical process in the body. Any cycle in the body requires the cofactors of vitamins and minerals. And when you're deficient in vitamins and minerals, things just don't work as well. So you start having poor sleep and no energy, start getting sick more often.
Well, hold that thought right there, and we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Carolyn. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Carolyn Dean. We're talking about a book, Death by Modern Medicine. Now, I mean, there are some medicines that are wonderful, but, you know, it's certainly a pain medicine when you're in pain, a post-operative pain, things like that. Oh, I mean, really are great and wonderful things, and there are wonderful things that we can give. For instance, you know, with pregnancy and with delivery and all of these things, you know, really are so helpful. But, well, I can remember when I was a young doctor, one of the things we gave a woman who was threatening to miscarry was estrogens. Give her large amounts of estrogen so she would not have a miscarriage. And, you know, it seemed to help. Women did, they would settle down, they wouldn't have the miscarriage, but 20 years later, the daughters of those women had cancer of the vagina and cancer of the vulva and had to have their whole genitalia removed. A terrible, terrible consequence, because we did not have a long-term study on this. Mm-hmm. What they did, of course, with the, for instance, the COX-2 inhibitors, is they did the initial limited studies. Merck company withheld from the FDA the truth about how dangerous the drugs were. They told the, and this is all part of the public record, they told their detail people, if the doctor asks about the relationship between our product, Vioxx, and heart disease, why you're to tell them, well, they should write to the drug company. So they would then, most doctors would not write to Merck, but if they did write to Merck, then Merck would write back and say, well, you know, we think that you ought to go to the FDA to get the latest information. Well, now, most doctors are not going to write to the drug company to begin with. Then they're going to write to the Federal Drug Administration, knowing full well, of course, Merck knew that they had not told the FDA of all the terrible consequences and complications they were getting. So they intentionally withheld the information from the doctors. The doctors were pressured to prescribe Vioxx and Bextra and Celebrex, you know, and, oh, this is the panacea. These are wonderful drugs that are going to relieve your pain. And they knew it dramatically increased the incidence of heart disease. And that's why, of course, the jury gave a $256 million judgment against Merck, because Merck knew that they were going to kill people. But the important thing is that they lied to their drug salespeople, and the drug salespeople lied to the doctors, and the doctors lied to the patients, not knowingly. The detail people didn't know, the doctors didn't know, but certainly the patients didn't know, and many of them paid with their lives. The estimate is somewhere between 88,000 and 160,000 Americans, and that's just in the United States, had either a heart attack or stroke directly attributable to Vioxx, and of those, 30-40% died. How can you justify that? Is anybody going to go to prison? Nobody's going to be punished at all. It's all right to lie. If you work for a major corporation, you can lie all you want to, and you will never be cited for perjury. Well, isn't that strange? I wonder why.
Well, money, money, money. Well, one of the notes we made in our article, News with Views article, by September 2001, the FDA was finally forced to send a warning letter to Merck advising the company, advising them, not forcing them, to list heart attack as a warning in the Vioxx package inserts. But during that same year, Merck's PR propaganda machine hired the famous figure skater Dorothy Hamill to launch a direct-to-consumer marketing campaign to encourage patients to talk to their physicians about taking the pill that Dorothy was taking. And that year, while all this, you know, scandal was brewing, Vioxx actually increased their sales. They were already at the $2 billion mark, and they had an 18% increase up to about $2.6 billion, in spite of the growing concern about the drug. So, in the face of all this talk and adverse reaction, what do? They pay, you know, a few million dollars to this actor.
She was a figure skater. She was very famous.
No, but she was acting. She was being paid to act like, oh, I have arthritis and take this drug. And, you know, I wish these people would take responsibility for what they're doing.
Well, I'll never forget those pictures of her skating, you know, and the beautiful skating, and then, of course, the little children. And they were all in a line, all holding hands, skating, and she was leading the way as they skated gracefully across the skating rink, you know. And, of course, it's all because of Vioxx, and they knew it was going to kill people.
Yep.
We're going to be back here in just a moment, here with Dr. Carolyn Dean and her book, Death by Modern Medicine. And, you know, it's something we don't like to think of, but you're going to have to be responsible for your health, and you're going to have to read those package inserts. And when you read what it says, or read the PDR and some of these drugs, you'll be quite surprised, as I was, as I began to read them, the medicines my doctor wanted to give me. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Carolyn Dean, and we're talking about her book, Death by Modern Medicine. And certainly the COX-2 inhibitors, they were pain pills. Of course, they were designed to relieve discomfort, but not upset the stomach, because certainly with many of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, aspirin, naproxen, others, Motrin, there sometimes people will get the gastric hemorrhage, and a certain number of people would die from that. And so they tried to use the fact that people are going to die of heart attack by saying, well, you know, they're going to die of heart attack, but look, some other people would die of gastric bleeding. Whereas, of course, the whole thing would be to certainly take your medication regularly with food, and if you started to have GI upset, you kind of just have to get off that medication for the time being. But then, what have you found as far as sugar is concerned? Does sugar have a tendency in any way to aggravate some of the pain or some of the arthritic symptoms?
Yes, it does seem to. It causes fluid retention, and it seems to aggravate aches and pains of all kinds. And then when you look at sugar and the way it drains the body of minerals, then if it's lowering your magnesium content, for example, you're going to have more muscle aches and pains. I constantly hear from people who've taken magnesium on my recommendation from my book, The Miracle of Magnesium, and even people with fibromyalgia. If they can take several doses of magnesium through the day, it relieves their muscle cramps and spasms. It starts to detoxify their muscles. So sugar, the way it is devoid of any nutrients itself, it's devoid of the nutrients, so it's empty calories, and it also depletes the body of minerals. And sugar, people don't realize that a can of soda can have 10 teaspoons of sugar, and the body at any one time only has about 2 teaspoons of sugar. So when you hit it with 10 teaspoons, you throw everything off. You throw off your insulin and the way the body stores sugar and the way the cells react to insulin and to sugar. And you, over time, if you're having a can or two of pop every day, then you're going to get into a syndrome called insulin resistance. And that's the next step to diabetes.
And of course, the other problem is that then if you take the diet pop, then you get to your NutraSweet there, and that produces the pathological obesity, and we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Carolyn Dean. We're talking about her book, Death by Modern Medicine. If you'd like to know more about that, why, you can call 1-800-544-8927. We'll give you Dr. Dean's website here just a little later this evening. But we were talking about the impact of sugar, and the impact of sugar certainly on our diet. And when we're taking, regular Coke or regular Pepsi or these other things with large amounts of sugar in them, why, they impact on your body. They certainly impact on the cell metabolism. They certainly tend to stimulate the insulin production, and they actually, down the line, can contribute to the exhaustion of the islands of Langerhans in your pancreas and the onset of diabetes, or even more frightening is the insulin-resistant type of diabetes. But then the problem is that so many people then, they're not going to take the regular diet, the regular Coke and the regular Pepsi, they're going to take the diet products, and those contain NutraSweet in them, which in many respects is even more dangerous. So it's really not a very good choice between sugar and NutraSweet, is it, Dr. Dean?
No, it's not. So we recommend stevia to people. And there's a new sugar out called Just Sugar. I think that's what it's called. And my friend Betty Martini, who is the anti-aspartame proponent, and she has a website, doorway.com, D-O-R-W-A-Y, she's studying this Just Sugar product and feels it may be safe for people, but she's putting it through a number of researchers before she'll confirm that. But in the meantime, people can go to their health food store and get stevia. It comes in drops or a white powder or green powder. But I find that, you know, when you stop taking desserts and using sugar in your tea and whatnot, that your taste buds get more sensitive, and just the sugar from fruit is enough to satisfy your taste buds.
All right, fine. Well, let's talk a little bit about the statin drugs. You know, the statin drugs, we're told, my goodness, everybody should be taking these statin drugs. Because it's going to, of course, cut down on the level of the cholesterol. Well, how do statin drugs cut down on the level of the cholesterol? Why, they simply suppress or poison the liver. Ordinarily, the liver produces cholesterol. You need the cholesterol. You need it to produce your sex hormones. You need it for the function of your brain. You need it for the metabolism of your cells. The cell linings, the cell membranes are made up of cholesterol. Cholesterol is essential to the health of the body. And what we're going to do is begin to poison the liver so it won't put out so much cholesterol. So you'll have a lower reading when you go to the doctor. And initially, when I first entered medical school, the normal cholesterol was 280. And then when I was practicing medicine, the upper limit was 230. And then, of course, you can't sell that much of the way of statin drugs if you have these high levels as normal. So they came in and they said, oh, no, you've got to get it down below 200. Now they're saying you've got to get below 170. And if they can sell that to the American people, they'll be able to sell statin drugs to 50 million Americans. They made $26 billion last year. Now, what do the studies really show as far as increasing longevity and preventing death? Have you read those statistics?
Oh, yes. They barely help at all. And, you know, they try to squeeze out a few years of statistics and say, well, it'll increase lifespan by this or that, but when then they look at the other side effects, like the suicide, the rhabdomyolysis, which is the destruction of leg muscle, when they add up all these side effects, in fact, the cholesterol drugs aren't doing very much at all. And in fact, the study that I found compares the mechanism and function of magnesium and statin drugs, and it tells us that in fact magnesium at the proper concentrations in the body is as good as a statin drug, and at the same time it's a natural calcium channel blocker, so it'll help with blood pressure. So in fact magnesium can take the place of the statin and not have any side effects.
Well, I think one of the most interesting studies was one of the Pravacol studies. We have it, if anybody would like to check on that, or at least we have the information from it. But, you know, there was a fairly substantial number of people who were actually evaluated, and in the group that did not take the Pravacol, 5.7% of the people died. And the group that did take the Pravacol, 4.6% of the people died. But, of course, then they said, see, we got a 20% increased longevity because, of course, the people who took it. What they do is, figures don't lie, but liars can figure, and they can juggle those statistics. 20% increased or less chance of dying if you take this drug. Well, that sounds you know, pretty good. Mm-hmm. Until you actually find, you look and see what the figures actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this over and over again. I'll never forget when I went to the doctor and he wanted to put me on antihypertensive medications because for 60 years, or my 50 years, my blood pressure had been running about 150 systolic. He told me I had to get it down to 120. And it used to be that 150 was normal for somebody who was 75, but that's not true anymore. Oh, no, we've got to get it down to 120. And he gave me the samples, but they had the package insert, and I read that, you know, and I think if you took their medication, why, 10.5% of the people died, and if you didn't take it, 12% of the people died. And with all the complications you can get from taking the medication, is it really worth it?
I know. It's very surprising because, yes, as we get older, our blood vessels are going to get a little stiffer. I mean, not even due to atherosclerosis, but just naturally a little bit stiffer like everything else does. And for them to tell an older person that they have to get their blood pressure down to 120, it could mean that it decreases the blood getting to their brain. And this is why so many of these drugs cause dizziness, and then an elderly person falls and breaks a hip, and there you go. You've got another unreported side effect of the overuse of these medications. And yes, unfortunately, as you say, it's trying to increase the market and the sales of these drugs to where, you know, everybody has to have this absurdly low cholesterol and this absurdly low blood pressure.
But of course, the trouble is, if you have a very, very low cholesterol, what does it do to your brain? Because your brain is predominantly made up of cholesterol and fat. It's one of the major ingredients of the brain and of the nerves. And so many people begin developing dementia. And nobody can figure it out what it is. My goodness, my figures for my cholesterol figures are so low, but I just can't remember anything anymore.
Well, isn't there that global amnesia symptom that some people get with the statin drugs, where they just lose their memory?
And of course it does, because the cholesterol is essential to the function of the brain. But you've got great figures, you know. You go to the doctor and he looks at that and says, aha, we got you down to 170. But what about your general health? And actually, the statistics show that a lot of the people, you know, will die of other things if they don't die of heart attacks. And, of course, even more frightening is the marked increase in cancer. The one study I mentioned, in that study, of course, it was not predominantly women. There were relatively few women in it. But in the placebo group, one woman got breast cancer the best. In the group that took the Pravacol, 12 women got cancer the best. And, of course, they excused that, saying, well, it was such a small group of women. It really didn't matter. It wasn't statistically significant.
If
it had been the other direction, they sure would have been. Would say, you know, and look how much it protects against cancer. And so figures don't lie, but liars figure. But when you're talking about an industry that made $26 billion just in statin drugs last year, why, you could understand why maybe a little thing like being carcinogenic would not be that important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is quite a study that you quote. And we have to remind people that when you look at something like, what, say 5.7 people died on the placebo and only 4.6 died on the drug, well, then you look at the numbers. I did that with a study on osteoporosis, and they were trying to tell people to take the, you know, the Prozimax drug and saying how much it improved people's survival, and, you know, they weren't getting hip fractures and all the rest of it. But when you took this group of 12,000 people, and then you see that the placebo group, I think it was, you know, 8 people had fractures, and in the Fosamax group, you know, maybe 6 people had fractures. So they said, oh, there's this again, 20% improvement with the Fosamax. So it's, you know, when you put it down to numbers, it's nothing. It just doesn't make any sense. But
oh, it makes a lot of sense. A lot of with a big dollar sign in front of those cents.
Yeah.
And that's really what's so unconscionable. They have people, they work full time to deceive the public. And you've got, if you're out there in the listening audience, you need to begin to taking care of your own health and learning what you can do to be healthy. And a lot of it is not necessarily taking the latest proprietary drug where there's no long-term follow-up on that. And remember those poor women who, when I was in medical school and early in my residency, were given large doses of estrogen so they would not have a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. And it was their daughters who paid the price for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the way estrogen was promoted, I just took possession of a new book called Hormone Balance, and I went through the history of the estrogens, and the chemists and the doctors decided that menopause was an estrogen deficiency disease. They didn't really have any studies to prove that, and right away they went about, you know, trying to manufacture estrogen. And when people weren't buying it, you know, when women weren't rushing to get this new estrogen, they created a whole marketing campaign. They hired a doctor, Dr. Wilson, to write a book and tell women that they were deficient in estrogen, that they were losing their femininity, and you know, create this whole psychological need for estrogen. And that book, with no research, no science behind it at all, started to create this demand by women for estrogen. And it wasn't until just a couple of years ago that we finally did the studies that proved once and for all that estrogen, synthetic estrogen, and the synthetic progestins are in fact causing cancer. Yet doctors are still using it, and you know, women are still, I see ads on TV talking, well, talk to your doctor, estrogen may be something that you need. And I think there's another one of these paid celebrities that's promoting estrogen, whereas there are so many natural options and choices for women to use.
Well, I'll never forget when I was in my medical training, and I was a senior, I think I was the senior resident at the University of California in orthopedic surgery, and I ran a clinic, and we, of course, had patients there, and one of the women, I've forgotten what the reason for it was, but she was going to what they call the stone and bone clinic there, where, of course, they did analysis of bone structure and hormones, and they placed this woman on estrogen. Well, she came in, I examined her a few months later and found she had a breast carcinoma, and I sent her back down to the clinic and said, this woman shouldn't be on estrogen. Why, she's got breast cancer. Well, the man who was running the study was furious, and he really got after his residents for not having evaluated her. So they were running a controlled study, so they took the woman out of the controlled study. And I would never forget a year or so later hearing this same man get up and say, we have all of these women on estrogen, and not one of them has developed breast carcinoma. And I thought, well, now wait a minute, I remember that case that had breast carcinoma. There's one of your group, but what they do is, if they certainly don't fit into the category, they throw them out of the study, and then they can get up and say, our study shows, but they've actually fixed the ultimate conclusion. Mm-hmm. And tragically, we have people within the scientific community. When you have a community where you have no God, where you have no right, no wrong, you get ahead in the medical and in the scientific community by writing articles and getting them published and getting your name before the medical community. But if there is no right and there's no wrong, what's wrong with falsifying those studies? And tragically, science at one time was dedicated to the search of truth. Today, it's, of course, dedicated to getting ahead in the academic world. And unfortunately, when a nation has turned its back on God, on morality, and you get ahead by lying and deceiving, and this goes on so often in the scientific community today. Mm-hmm. And the great tragedy is many people, you know, are being influenced by these studies, which are invalid.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a recent study, it's back at Harvard, if we discussed this with Dr. Kennedy, where a scientist had actually studied the incidence of osteogenic sarcoma in young boys in areas where the water was fluoridated.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, he found a significant increase, a sevenfold increase in osteogenic sarcoma in boys in areas where the water was fluoridated. So to alter that, he added all sorts of women and old men to the study to change the statistical value.
Mm-hmm.
And he simply lied about it. His assistant was an honest individual who came forward and said, why, those studies are totally invalid, you know, and they falsified the figures. How many children are going to develop osteogenic sarcoma in communities that are fluoridating the water? The tragedy is children are dying today because fluoride, water fluoridation, is carcinogenic, not simply cancer of the bone, but other cancers as well, because it loses free radicals in the system. And the fact that the average person doesn't realize that simply reflects the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. And any of our listeners out there who would like to see information on that study back at Harvard University, where one of the chief scientists there intentionally falsified the results, well, we'll be glad to provide it for you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544. 8927. What a tragic thing it is for people like myself and Dr. Dean and many other doctors who are really dedicated to doing what's right to find there are people within the scientific community. We're not dedicated to that same goal. Dr. Dean, let's get out your website right now and how people can get in touch with you.
Yes, it's carolyndean.com. Just simply carolyndean.com. And that site has my other sites of Friends of Freedom International. It takes you to my books, and you can purchase them on Amazon.com and go to my newswithviews.com articles as well on the newswithviews.com website.
Okay, fine. Thank you so much, Dr. Dean. We're just a few more minutes, and we'll let you go. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Carolyn Dean, and Dr. Carolyn Dean, her book is Death by Modern Medicine, if you're interested. Fascinating information here. A good overview of what's going on in our country today. And the tragic commentary that we have people within the industry who are more interested in profits than they are in the health of the patients. So, Dr. Dean, we've got about 2.5 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. I think with what I learned with Death by Modern Medicine over in Rome at the Codex meetings, now I want to alert people to the fact that the DSHEA, D-S-H-E-A, Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, it's under attack now because I think the pharmaceutical companies feel that they're slipping with their drugs. They want to control dietary supplements now. So if people will go to the nationalhealthfreedom.org, www.nationalhealthfreedom.org, you can find out more about these bills that are being suppressed. There's one you have to phone your congresspeople about. It's Bill 3156. That's going to try to overturn DSHEA. So we really have to keep fighting to keep healthy these days, and that's one way you can do it.
Now, DSHEA has been around for a long time. What did DSHEA say, basically? That it's
that supplements are safe, that there's no danger to them.
All right.
And, we should freely be able to take them, and that's being eroded.
Yeah, and what really I think we'd point out that the drug companies are putting out a great deal of money to hire people to do fraudulent studies to say, oh, vitamin E doesn't do any good, it gets you all sorts of trouble. Vitamin C is not effective. Echinacea that many people take for their colds doesn't work at all. Mm-hmm. And we've got the scientific studies to prove it. But many times they will actually alter the parameters of these studies and they will set out with a preconceived notion. Why? Because this is cutting into, of course, the business of the drug companies. Could anything like that really happen? Well, you have to know, you have to read the studies very carefully. And tragically, many of these are fraudulent, and they want to do away with DSHEA so that they can cut off our access to vitamins and minerals and other herbs. Isn't that correct, Dr. Dean?
Yes, in order to hike up the prices, make more money for the pharmaceutical companies, and they'll end up being synthetic, we won't be able to get high quality natural source supplements, and maybe it's another way that they're eroding our health as well. Because
we're out of time. Good night. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Doctor.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here. For the skeptic out there, there's another excellent book called What You Should Know About the Drug Companies. It's written by Dr. Marcia Angel, who was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, certainly the most of all the medical journals out there. That is, through the last decades, that has been the most prestigious. She was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine as a staff physician at Harvard University. And What You Should Know About the Drug Companies, an excellent, excellent book. Going into what the drug companies are doing and falsifying material and bringing pressure to bear on doctors who try to tell the truth. And I will tell you, I've tried to get hold of Dr. Angel to be on our programs, and and I can't get hold of her at all. She will not answer her emails. I think that they've put such pressure on her to make her life very, very miserable. And, of course, Dr. Dean has done an excellent job with her book, Death by Modern Medicine. There's so much information out there you need to have access to so that you can look after your own health. We do hope that many of you will certainly go to our website, www.radioliberty.com. There you can listen to our programs on the Internet, directly or indirectly, 5 hours a day. 3 hours on Radio Liberty, an hour on Genesis, an hour on the American Freedom Network. You can listen to our archive programs. And we ask you to go ahead and to listen to the programs, record them, get them to other people, because they need to learn the truth about what's going on today. And then, of course, we hope that you'll pull down my newsletters. And I think it was November and December of 2004, we did newsletters going into the background of fluoride and water fluoridation, how it is being used to harm our children. And we simply give you the entire background of Dr. William Hersey's testimony. Dr. Hersey testified before the Senate back in the year 2000. He is the vice president of the union of scientists who work for the Environmental Protection Agency, and they've been trying to tell the American people that they're being poisoned by the policies that the Environmental Protection Agency is supporting. These are their scientists. But you see, the bureaucrats, many of them, have their positions, their political appointments, and they can't fire the scientists. They'd like to. The scientists are trying to tell the people, if you get my December 2004 newsletter, that's December 2004. It is the testimony of Dr. William Hersey before the United States Senate in the year 2000, totally blacked out across America. Go to www.radioliberty.com and simply pull down the November and December newsletter. December newsletter is Dr. Hersey's testimony. Read it. Understand really what we're up against. And then, of course, help us to get the truth out, because they're hurting children. They're hurting children in America today. And the fact that this information is being covered up would suggest that we're not getting the entire truth from what I refer to as the controlled media, which is controlled by five mega corporations. That's covered in a book called The New Media Monopoly by Professor Ben Bagdakian of the University of California. He was the chairman of the Department of Journalism out there for many years. Dr. Bagdakian, in many respects, would probably disagree with many of my views, as I might disagree with his, but what he says about the media is absolutely right. The book, The New Media Monopoly, there's so much information that you need to get to understand, because, of course, the life you save could be your own. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station that you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have us on the line, Liz McIntyre. We're going to be talking about the RFID identification, about the surveillance society that is descending upon us. Now, most people really are totally oblivious of what's going on, as we see increasing demand that everybody in America carry an identification card. Why do we have to do that? Why, we're involved in a war on terrorism. And, of course, we have all these illegals coming in from south of the border, and we don't know who the American citizens are. So they've done everything they could to allow the illegals to come in. They've done everything they could to encourage them to come in, offering them free health care, offering them education for their families. They can even buy homes here in America today with nothing down. If you're an illegal citizen, you can get free education or education to reduce sum of money. Here in California, if you're an illegal alien, you can go to our universities and our colleges here in California for less than an American citizen from Nevada can. We do everything we can to encourage the illegals to come into this country from other countries, and then we say, well, but we're going to have every American citizen have an ID card, because how else are we going to find out who's legal and who's not? So they create the problem, and then they have a solution. And that solution is not to take care of illegal immigration. It's to take away the freedom of the American people, to the point where soon you'll neither buy nor sell unless you have some sort of a government mark or government identification. Well, Liz McIntyre and her friend Catherine Albrecht are writing a book going into the background of so what so much is going on. Liz, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Hi, Dr. Stan. How are you?
Doing just fine. So why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how it was that you got involved, in this whole concept of the surveillance society, this whole idea that everything is going to be marked, everything is going to be computerized, everything is going to be followed.
Sure. Catherine and I actually met a few years back when I was doing some articles on supermarket privacy cards. Supermarket loyalty cards. I was a writer and financial writer and family money columnist back then. A few years later, while I was researching some other information, I found some things that were unbelievable that I thought needed to be exposed in the book, and so I contacted Catherine again. It just so happened that she was also contemplating a book at the same time and suggested we write it together.
All right, fine. And so you are in the process of writing a book. And what's the title going to be and what's it going to be about?
Sure. It's Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. It should be in bookstores coming out October 4th, and it's available for pre-order at Amazon.com.
All right, fine. And the book then is Spy Chip. Spy Chip. And,
Spy Chips with an F.
Spy Chips. And, of course, what they're talking about is everything is going to be marked, everything is going to be regulated, everything is going to be kept on computers. So they will know where everything is, and, of course, if you have any of these items, they'll know who you are. We're going to be back here in just a moment, air at Radio Liberty with our special guest this evening, Liz McIntyre. Well, Liz, you get tall and into the whole idea of the grocery cards, the discount cards that they have at the grocery stores. So many people get those because, after all, they get food at a reduced price if they have these cards. I know Catherine has spoken extensively about that.
Sure. Actually, one of the applications we've seen is the idea of putting RFID chips, these spy chips, into loyalty cards, with the idea that when people walk into the stores, reader devices could read those cards as they walk in and perhaps even track them around the stores while they're shopping. And they envision a day when, oh, and they can't wait, when people could approach a shelf in a store and the price could change, flash a customer-specific price that would be based on your value to the store. So, for example, a person who comes in and typically buys beans and rice and a jar of peanut butter might pay, say, $5 for a jar of peanut butter, but a premium customer who buys more high-margin items and contributes more to the store's bottom line might pay only $3 for that. And that's to discourage people they don't want in their stores. Basically, why have unprofitable customers pushing around their cards, clogging up their stores, and breathing their valuable air?
Well, of course, even more interesting is the fact that when you have one of these ID cards, or customer-friendly cards, call it what you will, they actually tabulate and set up a profile on you, don't you? So they know exactly what you buy and what you want to buy and how often you're there. Aren't they collecting profiles on everybody who has one of those cards?
Absolutely. It's totally a marketing gimmick is what it is. They're telling people that they can save money by using the grocery store cards. But study after study has shown that you actually pay more at stores that have the cards than at stores without the cards. In fact, one Wall Street Journal study back in 2003, they surveyed five major markets around the United States, and they found that at every store they paid more, even with the built-in supposed savings, they paid more for items at stores with cards than with stores without cards, and in one case, they paid even 29% more at a no-card store.
Well, I think that this really is sort of a subterfuge. Most people should be smart enough to realize that they're doubling the price and then cutting it in half. Only sometimes they're not necessarily cutting it in half. Everybody's looking for a bargain, but believe me, there are no real bargains out there. What they're doing is gathering information on people, and they're using these cards to establish extensive computerized files on what you buy from them. And that information is up for sale, and we're going to be talking more about this in just a moment here with our special guest this evening, Liz McIntyre. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Liz McIntyre, and she has written a book with Catherine Albrecht, who's been a frequent guest on our program. It's going to be called Spy Chips. And we were just commenting that, so many of these grocery stores, they have discounts if you're part of the club, if you have one of their cards. And you go in there, and you, of course, if you belong to the club, well, you get things at maybe a third or maybe even a half off the cost. And you really think you're getting a bargain. Well, as Liz was saying, studies have shown you're not getting a bargain. In fact, in most of these stores that have these special cards, why, it's going to cost you a good deal more. In fact, in one store, they actually calculated, according to an article, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal, 29% more if you had a discount card. Now, the reason for that is they have to compile all this information. It can be compiled by computers, but then they have this information on you. They have a file on you that identifies you with that card. And then don't they actually sell this data actually to other groups?
Well, at this point, we don't know of any stores that are actually selling it, but they certainly could share that data. And even if they don't sell or share the data, having that information on file is a danger in and of itself. As we've seen with recent high-profile breaches of databases, like the recent Choice Point database breach, those databases aren't secure when you have personal information on them. Those records go back years and years and years, and, of course, if a government agent wants to go in and get that information, why, pretty much the stores pretty much have to turn that over. And in fact, there's a case, I believe it was in Arizona, where agents went in to a grocery store trying to find all the people who bought inordinate amount of baggies. Okay, who's buying all the baggies here? And they pulled the grocery store records, and they identified certain people buying extraordinary numbers of baggies to find people who might be using them to sell illegal substances. I guess that's how they bag things. Of course, they probably caught up with a few homeroom moms too, right? in that net. So these records are there for to be pierced by, you know, a hacker. They're there for government agents. One day they could fall into hands like of HMOs. I mean, one day we could have food nannies going around saying, "Oh, we see you buying, you know, too many Twinkies. That's not good. You've got to cut back. We're gonna tell you you can't buy more, or your insurance premiums might go up because you're buying too many Twinkies." There are all kinds of possibilities with this data.
I remember there was one story that Catherine tells about a gentleman who was in a store, as I remember, and he slipped and fell and first hurt himself. Well, when the case went to trial, he was injured, and he brought a suit against the store because they had something on the floor that he slipped on, and the store had the record of how much alcohol he'd bought in the past. And the inference was, when they presented it at trial, they had the records of every bottle of wine or alcohol he'd bought, or whiskey, and the inference was he must have been drunk when this happened. So they used their records on his purchases against him to win the case. Did you hear about that case?
I did hear about that. I've heard about several cases in which records like that have been taken. People don't expect those records to be used in that way.
As a matter of fact, most people don't even understand that they're correcting records on everybody in these stores where they have these special discount cards, and they're getting people to use them thinking they're getting a bargain, which is actually costing them more.
Absolutely. And the frightening thing that's going to happen with these cards, once they have the RFID chips in them, is that they'll be remotely readable. And maybe we need to talk a little bit about, you know, what RFID is. I know you know, Dr. Stan, but to give the audience a sense of the implications of that kind of a future where the cards we have now that you have to swipe or turn over to the cashier could suddenly be remotely readable. And RFID technology, well, RFID stands for radio frequency identification, and that's a technology that uses very, very small computer chips, some smaller than a grain of sand, to track items at a distance. And each of these chips contains a unique identification number, and that uniquely identifies the product to which it's attached. So basically, no other product in the world would have that number. And you could say it's like a social security number for everyday objects.
Every item in the world, then, would be numbered. This is what they really want, isn't it?
Every car tire, every shoe, every shirt, every pair of pants.
Every undershirt, every underpants.
Everything. A pack of gum one day they're hoping to be able to tag. And, you know, it goes beyond that. They want to put tags on your cars so that when you drive down the street, police could drive by without even leaving their vehicles and figure out who you are and whether you've registered your vehicle properly. There are all kinds of applications of radio frequency identification. And to get a sense of what a nightmare this technology is, it's helpful to know, you know, a little bit about how these work. These chips, these tiny chips, are hooked up to miniature antennas that allow them to communicate these unique numbers they will have on them by radio waves. And these radio waves are similar to the ones that are allowing everyone out there in your audience tonight to listen to us, Dr. Stan. And just like those radio waves, carrying your broadcast message to your listeners that go right through the walls of your homes or offices, these RFID radio waves can travel through solid objects, things like walls, clothing, purses, and wallets. You know, the things that we normally think of as being private places, places we can, you know, put things and expect someone's eyes aren't going to put, you know, be on them. If you get a sense of how that technology works, you can see, wow, you know, you get this into a loyalty card, one of these supermarket loyalty cards, and if that card can be read at a distance, well, when you're walking into the doors of the store, a reader device set up in the doorways could pick up that unique number and identify who you are.
Now, I think, isn't there a difference between the active chip and the passive chip? Could you explain what the difference would be? And would the chip in the card be an active or a passive chip?
Well, at this point, most of the RFID tags, That's the combination of that little chip and antenna. Most of these tags are supposed to be passive, meaning that they don't have a battery on board. And in order for the number to be read on those, they have to come within range of a special reader device. And this device would send a burst of energy to that tag, and in response, that tag would send back that unique number. Okay? Then you have the active tags, and the active tags are tags that have batteries on board, which makes them a little bit more powerful, actually can be far more powerful. Rather than having to wait around for a reader to come in range, these chips can beam out the unique number, and they can beam it out much further than the passive tags. The passive tags, you know, they can have a read range up to 30 feet. In fact, one case, a recent test got 69 feet, a 69-foot read range. So that means someone could stand back 69 feet and actually pick up the unique number on an object. And this is on a tag without a battery.
But, of course, they could also stand 69 feet away from you. And, of course, they get the reading off of your identity card, and they would know who you were, and you wouldn't even know you were being monitored.
Exactly. That's the danger with this, because you don't know when someone's secretly siphoning a number. And one thing that Caspian, which is an organization I belong to, and, of course, Catherine, you've had her on many times, is the founder and director of Caspian. We have a model legislation requesting that items carrying RFID tags be labeled. So, first of all, you know, we know that there's an RFID tag in there, because we might never know that something's in there. These things are so, so small. I mean, some of them are just, you know, the size of a speck of dust, and they're so paper thin they can be slipped between layers of cardboard. They can be slipped under the insole of a shoe. They can be slipped into a clothing label. We've actually seen prototype clothing labels with RFID tags in them. And they're so flexible, I mean, and so it's unbelievable. It's like it's not even there. So consumers might never know. So we feel like there's the need for labeling legislation. And we also believe that consumers should be told about the privacy implications of these tags.
Of course, they don't want the people to know that everybody is being numbered, everybody is being monitored, everybody is being watched. They're putting in video cameras every place. Through the miracle of satellite, they can watch people on the ground. They can read a newspaper from outer space. They can track people where they're going. Every cell phone has its chip in it so that they can monitor that if it's on, and sometimes they can monitor even if it isn't on. And the same thing is increasingly true with cars. If they have some sort of global positioning satellite in it, they will know exactly where your car is. And most people say, well, why should I be worried about that? And so let me ask you that question, Catherine. Why should we be worried about that? Isn't this a wonderful technology that's going to make sure nobody can steal our undershirt or whatever?
Well, right. They're trying to sell it to us like it's going to be helpful to us. But the real danger in this is that once every object in the world contains an RFID tag, and by the way, that is the vision of major companies, like you're talking Walmart, you're talking Procter & Gamble, you're talking Gillette, Unilever, Nestle, you name a major company, their plan is to have an RFID tag with a unique identification number on it so you can uniquely identify and every object in the world. So, for example, every six-pack of Coke, every single can in that six-pack would have its own unique number, okay? So in that kind of a world where objects are remotely trackable by association, the people who carry, wear, and interact with those objects can also be tracked, especially in a situation where those numbers are somehow registered to individuals. For example, you brought up the loyalty card example. If you buy something at a store and you present a loyalty card, well, they could associate that unique number with you.
And, of course, they know who owns that card, don't they? I mean, when you take out the card, you fill out an application form. So when you have that identity card, that loyalty card, they know who you are, don't they?
They absolutely do. And I've gone in and seen how they do it. They want to see a driver's license. They want to verify your information is correct.
Right. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Liz McIntyre. And if you understand, we're moving towards a totally regulated, totally regimented society, just like they had in Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia, but far more sophisticated than you could ever imagine in your worst nightmare. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest Liz McIntyre, and she and Catherine Albrecht, who's been a frequent guest on our program, are writing a book called Spy Chips. And of course, the question that I'd asked Liz is, but what's wrong with that? I mean, after all, we would be able to tell who was, if somebody had shoplifted some of those six cans of Coke or Pepsi, we'd be able to tell if somebody had shoplifted various things. Wouldn't that be an advantage to having that, so people could not so readily steal things out of the stores?
Well, that's one thing they're trying to say. They're painting this technology as being so helpful to society. But if you think about it, if you want to be able to figure out, for example, whether an item actually belongs to a person, you want to say, oh, you know, whether that's been robbed from someone's house, you would actually have to keep these RFID tags live, and you'd have to register them to individuals so that you'd always know who belongs to what, or really, how could you ever prove anything?
But, of course, they will have this capacity with the massive computer files that they have. I mean, they're collecting dossiers on everybody. They would have a file on every undershirt you had, on every shirt you had, on every pair of shoes and socks, every handkerchief. They would have files on literally everything you possess. It can all be kept there in the computer. And then if you were kidnapped, wouldn't it be wonderful if they could track you down, identify you, and rescue you from the wicked kidnappers? I mean, I'm thinking of all the rationale that they're going to put out, you know, to justify this sort of thing, because we're from the government and we're here to help. And after all, we're trying to protect you from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's living over in a cave in Pakistan. That's why we've got to do this to the American people.
So, well, absolutely, Dr. Stan, you're right. They're trying to come up with all kinds of reasons. And, of course, since 9/11, the reason they tout is, wow, we have to protect ourselves from terrorists. And, of course, that's the excuse they're going to give to eventually put RFID tags in our driver's license, which would be a de facto national ID. The reason they're giving to put RFID tags in our passports, which, by the way, they're already starting to do. They have a test with airline employees right now traveling internationally to see how that would work, and they're planning to start issuing these RFID tagged passports in the spring of 2006 now. And all of this is supposed to keep us all safer, but in actuality, when you can track people and monitor people, then you really are putting them, the people are really in danger. Right now, you may say, oh, we can trust our government. Well, some people will say that with this information. We can trust companies with this information. But, you know, one day, the person holding on the other end of the leash is Mother Teresa. The next day, it's, oh, say, Lindy England, right? So, you know, you have to be very careful. This technology, while you might say, oh, is now in good hands or will be in good hands, you just don't know what the next regime will be. You never know who's going to be on our shores. Can you imagine someone getting a key to a database with all the RFID tags, and there are things like, you know, who owns all the guns in the country and where they live, or I guess you can come up with all kinds of examples. Cars, tracking cars is another good example. We've seen in Houston, Texas, for example, people there in Houston, Texas, have toll tags on the cars, presumably just to pay their tolls. I mean, that's why people buy these toll tags, to speed through the toll booths. Well, Dr. Stan, unbeknownst to many people in Houston who have those tags.
Hold that stuff right there for just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Liz McIntyre, and of course we're talking about the RFID technology. And these chips that they want to put into cards, they want to put them into your passport, they want to put them into your underwear, they want to put them into certainly the tires of your cars, and apparently Michelin has been talking about putting the RFID technology so they could follow their tires. These are being put into animals today, they're being put into chickens, they're being put into cows so they can't be rustled. But actually Liz was talking about so many people will have these monitors on their cars so that when it comes, they're in a, going on a toll road and they don't have to get in line with everybody else. They can take the adjacent road, of course, and that because they have this special little device, usually on their windshield. It will identify them. It will charge them automatically, and they can speed right on through. And isn't that convenient? But what's wrong with that, Liz? What's the problem with having one of those special monitors on your car so that you can get special treatment?
Well, actually, that's interesting that the RFID tag, the toll tags on cars are actually RFID devices. Most of them are active tags, and they communicate unique information about your vehicle, like uniquely identifying your vehicle, and that's to, presumably, to allow you to pay tolls at the toll booth. And I've seen the detailed records that come out of these toll tags. These toll tag incidents at the toll booth, they know exactly who you are, what time you've been there, where you've been, and of course they can monitor you as you drive down the road. And what many people don't know is that these toll tags are also being read miles from the toll booth in Houston and in other cities in the country. They're doing it right now, they say, to monitor traffic conditions, to see how fast cars are driving. But if they can pick up that unique number, say like in Houston, every 1 to 2 miles or so, they have these readers picking up these numbers. One day that could be turned to a very different purpose, and you could get very detailed histories of people's driving habits, and of course that tells you a great deal about a person.
And, Chris, what they're doing is accumulating information on people. And when they know everything about you, they know every detail of your life, what you drink, what you eat, what sort of food you get, how much money you have, what your financial records are, what your health records are. All of this information is being collected. They're collecting dossiers on every American citizen. And if you doubt that, I suggest you read the book Fixing Intelligence by General William Odom. For many years, the director of the NSA, the most secret of all secret organizations here with 30 or 40,000 employees. In fact, NSA is set in Washington, D.C. No such agency, because for many years, nobody even knew it existed. Even many members of Congress didn't know this vast organization didn't exist. That's collecting dossiers on you. And if you read General William Odom's book, he asks, he can't tell you what's going on because he's so a sworn oath of secrecy. But he asks, should the Defense Department be collecting dossiers on American citizens? And I would simply ask you that, Liz. Do you think the Defense Department should be keeping dossiers on American citizens? I thought the Defense Department was to defend us from foreign enemies, not the American people.
That is odd, isn't it, Dr. Stan? And frightening, too, at the same time. No, I don't believe they should be doing that. And you know what's more, Dr. Stan, a lot of people don't know this, but the government actually not only puts together dossiers based on information they might get that you submit to them, but they also are going out and getting and buying information from retailers. Actually, they buy things like records from IRI, which is a company that consolidates information on purchases from various stores. So using this information, the government does what's called data mining. That's looking for patterns in data to try to identify persons of interest.
And, of course, what's really so interesting is they tell you you're not to use cash. They don't want you to use cash. If you take out more than $10,000 in cash from your bank over the course of a year, it becomes a federal crime. The reason they don't want you to use cash is not because they're concerned that you might be a drug dealer, because, of course, the biggest drug dealers in the United States are really our own government. Who is it who's protecting the opium fields in Afghanistan today from being destroyed? Why, it's the American troops. When the Taliban were there, they shut off the drug industry. Since the American troops moved in, why, the drug industry is flourishing. So they're not really worried about whether you are a drug dealer here in the United States. If you were, they would know it, of course, and you'd be put out of business very, very promptly. But they really wanted you to use your credit cards. They want you to use all these other cards so they can monitor what you're doing. And as difficult as it seems for the average American to believe that, that's exactly what's going on in America today. We'll be right back with our special guest, Liz McIntyre, and, well, develop these ideas a little bit further. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Liz McIntyre, and we're talking about the RFID technology that, of course, they are increasingly using in cards and passports, but isn't the plan eventually to put this into everything, Liz?
Every single item on the planet, Dr. Stan. You're talking about car tires, shoes, clothing, you name it, everything.
Well, now, has there been actually meetings that have been actually talking about that? Because they're not putting them in everything just yet, are they?
Not yet. Actually, they're hoping the price is going to come down. And right now, they're just starting out. They're trying to get their bearings and get everything straight so that when the price does come down and they've convinced enough people that they have to do it in order to stay in business and supply major retailers like Walmart and so on, that they'll be ready. But that's they're thinking that certainly by 2007, you'll be seeing a lot more of these in the stores. Probably next year, probably sooner than you think. Already, like you said, we're seeing some in Michelin tires. There have been trials that have gone on in England in a store called Tesco, which is a very big store over there. They were in Gillette razor packages. We've seen them in a test in America in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where an RFID chip was placed in packages of Lipfinity lipsticks to try to track those and get a sense of the technology. And in another case, currently, in 7 North Dallas, Texas Walmart stores, there are reportedly RFID tags on certain Hewlett-Packard printers. Now, at this point, those tags are supposedly on the outside of the box, and supposedly they are labeled. Although labeled in a way that it makes you think there's no problem here, right? But they're labeled. But, of course, right now they're on the outside. One day we think that those things will be hidden because they're going to be using them not only to track inventory and track people around stores, but also as anti-theft devices, too. And like the anti-theft devices that are in stores today that are hidden deeply within products, it's called source tagging. We believe those RFID tags will be right along with those hidden in products and places where consumers cannot see them and can't get to those.
Well, I think it's a frightening concept to realize that there really are people who are working with this technology. Technology is advancing so rapidly, and it won't be long at all before they will have the ability to mark and monitor literally everything that exists in the world today. And we'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Liz McIntyre, to explore these concepts just a little bit further here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Liz was saying that right now, of course, they have tried the chips in Michelin tires. They've tried them in certain stores. They put them into lipsticks. In certain Walmart stores, they put them on certain items. It's all being experimented in that certain of the boxes that the Hewlett-Packard printers will come in. Why they will have this on the box, but of course they anticipate that later they'll be able to put them into the printer itself so it can be monitored as in case it's stolen. They can always come up with an excuse for why they're doing this. Always, we're here from the government, we're here from the industry, we're your friends, we just want to help you and keep people from stealing things from you. But is there another, possibly more diabolical agenda? Are they trying to create a situation where no one will be able to buy or sell, unless they have a number and what they're being buying and selling is numbered? Could we be moving towards the world that George Orwell wrote about in his classic book, 1984? And how do you feel about that, Liz? What's really going on? What's the real agenda behind these things we're talking about?
Well, right now I do believe that most retailers and manufacturers are thinking about how this is going to help them. They're not really, you know, they're trying to come up with excuses for consumers, but in all the literature that Catherine and I have found, they pretty much admit that it's pretty difficult to sell consumers on this technology because there aren't really good clear benefits from it. But for them, they see it as a way to track items around the world in their global commerce, to make sure that things get in their warehouse, to make sure they're not stolen from their warehouse, and to be sure that goods are on the shelves at all times. But But and we'll talk a lot more about this in our upcoming book, Spy Tips, that's due out very shortly in major bookstores. That there's actually another use for these tags, and that actually is tracking consumers. And while they say they would never track consumers with this technology, at least that's what they've said. We have evidence that actually they do plan to track consumers, and the government is actually overtly planning to track people. Right now, they have the U.S. visit program in place, where people coming over to visit our country are being issued spy chipped RFID documents, and passports are going to be carrying these RFID tags, and of course, driver's licenses with the Real ID Act could very easily carry these tags. And once you have something like that tagged, of course they're for tracking people, right? That's the whole purpose. A passport is to, at one time it was to authenticate that you were allowed to travel, but now it's more to monitor who's coming and going.
Well, now, is there any way that these down the line would be monitorable by the satellites up in the sky? In other words, would the satellite be able to send out a radio signal and give one back from your chip?
Well, at this point, the chips they're planning to use in the stores are passive, without batteries, and the cost would be prohibitive for them to have satellite tracking of everyday objects. However, there are some developments coming down the road, and it wouldn't surprise me if one day that were possible. They're developing paper-thin batteries. In fact, a company out of Israel called Power Paper is developing what they call cheap, thin, disposable batteries that could ride on board with RFID tags and make them active tags, which would transmit much further. And, of course, already today we have active tags that can communicate with satellites. If you look to our ocean's waters, where scientists are tracking things like, say, sea turtles and whales, they are able to put active RFID tags on them that include onboard batteries and GPS tracking devices. And when these animals surface, they are able to transmit the data that's being collected to low-orbiting satellites. So, yes, it is possible to communicate the unique identification number from an RFID tagged item to satellites. But at the present time, we don't see that as an immediate development.
Well, my understanding is that Tommy Thompson, former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare in the Cabinet, has gone to work for the Verichip company, which, of course, is coming up for a human identification chip, in other words, something to be injected to human beings. Have you looked into this at all?
Absolutely. It was shocking when we heard that Tommy Thompson, about 6 months after leaving the Bush administration, joined the board of Verichip. And, of course, the whole time he was in the administration, he was very supportive of the technology, featuring it and so on. And now that he's gone, he's in this cushy board position, and it didn't take him very long. In an interview in July on CBS MarketWatch, he was touting the Verichip, which is an RFID tag that's embedded in the human flesh, as you said. He was touting that as a great replacement, say, for military dog tags. And he was saying, oh, it'd be a great way to keep medical records on all Americans.
In other words, you'd have your medical records right with you then.
Right. Which is a scary thought, but at the same time, it's pretty preposterous, because we uncovered back in the fall last year, we found a memo, actually a letter to the Verichip people, when the FDA approved their device for keeping medical records. They approved it as a medical device, but there were some caveats. They said, you know, there are some concerns with these implantable chips. And one of the big concerns was MRI incompatibility.
Now, for the MRI, this is the machine that they put people into when they want to take these extensive x-rays that can almost chop you up into little pieces and get cross-sections of your body, your brain, or your shoulder. And they're wonderful, wonderful devices for making a diagnosis for surgeons or for physicians who are looking at the body. But what happens when you get into one of those machines and you've got a metal chip in your arm?
Well, it's interesting, because we have had discussions with a researcher at a university who was actually testing the Verichip to see what would happen if one of these things went through an MRI machine. Now, he didn't do this on a live person. He set up conditions that simulated what would happen to a chip in a live person. And his findings are that the current MRI machines, the chip would not, for example, fly out of your arm. Although, you know, with a higher powered machine, that could be possible because, as you know, MRI machines attract metal and they're very dangerous. But it's the current versions in the current MRIs, they probably won't shoot to your arm. However, when those chips go through the MRI, there's a high probability of failure. So then you would have your medical records on this chip in your arm, and then it might not reveal information when you really need it.
Well, of course, they don't really want to have our medical records with us. They want a means of identifying us. I really believe that is the real purpose behind this. And I think this idea of the medical records is simply a scam to justify putting these chips into people. And there's certainly you could say, wouldn't this be a lot better in the military situation than having to carry dog tags? And from the situation where you're going into battle, you could justify this, but I feel that this is just the prologue to putting them into everybody. They're putting them into animals, aren't they?
Absolutely. Millions and millions of animals have these chips embedded in them. Right. And by the way, the technology that's being used in humans is almost exactly, in fact, I don't really see the difference. It's really the same thing as what they're putting in animals. The same glass encapsulated tag, and I've looked at them side by side, and I really can't see the difference.
Well, of course, the thing is that what is the advantage to putting them in animals? Why are they putting them in animals?
Well, the whole idea is to be able to track animals. So if they run away and they get caught by a dog catcher and end up in a shelter somewhere, that the shelter workers could run an RFID reader over the animal and pick up a unique identification number. And then once they have that number, they would be able to call into a central service that contains all the records on the animals and be able to hopefully reunite the pet with the owner.
Well, of course, that really sounds pretty good. I mean, after all, most of us would hate to lose our dog or a cat or something we loved. So what's wrong with putting the chip into the animals?
Well, I don't personally have an objection to putting the chips in dogs and cats, but when you step over the line and you start putting them in human beings and you think, oh my goodness, the same thing they're doing with cats and dogs, having this central database of information about them, they could have that same information on me. And basically they have to develop these giant medical databases to contain this data. And as we know, that information is just ripe for abuse. We've seen recently with the Choice Point data grab where all those records of millions of Americans were scammed. There have been several incidents like that lately. So, do we want all of our medical information in a database for that reason? And then, really, do we want all our medical information accessible by anybody who says they have a reason? For example, our government. Do we want our government going in and knowing every single thing about us and our medical history?
Well, let me use the sophistic type of argument. If you're an honest person, I mean, if you're a good, loyal citizen, why should you be worried that the government has all this information on you? How do you answer that?
Well, we can look to history. Why don't we look back at, say, Stalin's Russia, or let's look back at the Third Reich. I mean, were people who were very surveilled, were they safer? I would argue no, they aren't safer. I mean, once you can monitor and track people, you can control them. And while you might say today, oh, we have a friendly government in place, I mean, some people would say that, we can trust these people, you don't know what you're going to have tomorrow. And you don't know who's going to have the key to those very detailed databases.
And I think that is an excellent answer. And for us people out there who are skeptical, there's a wonderful book. It's called Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, written by a friend of mine, Professor Sutton. And Professor Sutton went into who financed Adolf Hitler, largely American and British corporations and banks. And if you don't understand that Adolf Hitler was actually created and the terrible things that he did were largely financed and helped by people here in the United States and in England, and of course the other book, Trading with the Enemy by Charles Hingham, or Who Financed Hitler by the Pools. But of course these are things that are not taught in school. As far as Russia is concerned, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, goes into great detail on who it was who financed the Bolshevik regime, who Lenin was subservient to, and you'll actually read the words written by one of the men who was in Russia, sent there by Lord Milner in Great Britain. And he could never understand why Lenin was so subservient to him and to a man named Thompson, who was a representative of the American Federal Reserve Bank. So there's a lot that the American people don't understand about tyranny and what's happened in the past. But the one thing I think that our founding fathers realized was you could never trust government. In fact, Thomas Jefferson had said, "In matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution." And it looks to me like the tendency today is to take the chains off of the politicians and off of the government and prepare them for the people.
Right, actually, and you know, a lot of people today are looking to their government for solutions to everything in their lives. And in fact, a lot of people are looking to the government to regulate RFID tags. But we say, whoa, you know, the government is very excited about this technology, and it seems like they're very excited about tracking people. And, you know, if we want to put an end to this technology, if we don't think this is a good idea, going to our government is really not the right choice. We have to take some control back ourselves as consumers. And actually, there's a great deal that we can do to stop the problem ourselves.
What can we do to stop the problem ourselves?
Well, we have a big lever as consumers. We can vote with our pocketbooks. If we don't like something that a store is doing, let's say a Walmart, we don't like the idea that they're promoting RFID technology, we simply don't shop there. And by withholding our shopping dollars, we're sending a very strong message to them. We do not like what you're doing. And even better than that, rather than just not going, write them a letter. Tell them why you're not going.
You know, I've noticed that in one of our local stores here that has these loyalty cards, they don't do anywhere near as good a business as the students that don't have the loyalty cards and those phony discounts that they tell you you're getting, and actually they're jacking the prices up on you. I think that some of the people are aware of what's going on, and yet the local store continues the same failed policy. You have to ask yourself why.
Well, obviously, they think it's working for them. And, of course, once they've invested in this technology and they've been sold on it, I mean, obviously, there are salespeople going out and trying to convince stores, hey, this is a great thing for you to do. Look at what we can do for you. So, obviously, somebody's convincing them it's the right thing. And once they've made that investment, they have to have a return on that. So, obviously, they have to go with it. But we are seeing some stores getting smart and backing away from that once they realize the big money pit that is. Because they actually have a middleman in between, and that's why their prices have to be higher to support all this data gathering.
And I think that's what's so important, that what Liz is saying, is that when they start collecting all this information on you, somebody's going to have to pay for the amassing of this information, the filing of the information, for the analysis of the information, as, of course, they set up an extensive dossier on everybody who's foolish enough to go to the stores that are using this technology.
Right, right. And basically, we say the best thing to do is just not shop at those stores. You know, why? We don't want people going into those stores and using loyalty cards, but don't shop at those stores even. I mean, some people have said, oh, well, I just won't use my loyalty card there. Well, why would you go in and pay higher prices at a store like that? We have some people who will drive 50 miles away to go to a store just to avoid those things. And that's really a way consumers can fight these privacy issues. By voting with their dollars, I know it could be a little inconvenient sometimes, and maybe you say, oh, well, I could save so much money by shopping at, say, Walmart, you know, even though they're going to be putting RFID chips on everything. But at some point, we've got to take a stand. We've got to decide. We've got to take the power back ourselves. We've got to have a consumer movement, and we've got to get together and just put our foot down.
And I agree with you totally, and I really think it's so vitally important that people understand the implications of what's going on. Because I think we're moving towards a point in the very, very near future where we will neither buy nor sell unless we wear the mark of the beast. And as it says, you know, there in the, I believe it's Revelation 13, where they talk about the time will come when you'll neither buy nor sell this. You wear the mark of the beast or be known by the number of your name. Anyway, would you like to get your website out there?
Sure. Our website is www.spychips.com. That's spychips with an S. And our book that's coming up is called Spy Chips with an S, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID. I'm co-authoring that book with someone many of you know, Catherine Albrecht. And it should be out in major bookstores at the beginning of October. And it's available for pre-order now at Amazon.com.
All right, fine. And remember what it says in Revelation 18, and that no man might buy or sell, except that he had the mark or the number of the beast, or the number of his name. And here is wisdom. Let him who hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Ladies and gentlemen, could it be that we're seeing the fulfillment of prophecy, or is that too far-fetched for you? Well, we'll have to have you decide that, but I think as we go by, you're going to see increasingly efforts to number everyone, to control everyone, to regulate everyone. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Liz, we've got 3 minutes before we have to let you go. So why don't you sort of give your parting thoughts to our listeners, why they should be concerned, and why, of course, they should want to get your book when it comes out.
Well, they should be very concerned because major corporations are planning to put RFID tags on every single item in every store in America, and they're looking to do this around the world, too. So you won't be able to go anywhere at some point and buy anything without having some kind of an RFID chip embedded in it. Now, what that's going to look like, you know, it's going to be up to us. Are we going to let them do it? Well, if we vote with our dollars and we write to them and we tell them no, then it's possible that we can stop this. And the reason we should be so afraid is that once they can track individual objects with unique numbers that are on these RFID tags, by association, they can track each and every one of us. Our book coming up, Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID, is coming out in bookstores in October. It's also available at Amazon.com right now for pre-order. We'll explain all of this and so much more. We have lots of new information that we've never revealed before in the company's own words that proves that they do plan to track every one of us and all of humanity with this technology.
Well, I hope that you're going to give me a copy of the book as soon as it's out. You're not going to tell us all the information until the book's out, huh?
Well, we our publisher, Nelson Curran, is telling us right now to hold tight. We're just bursting at the seams, wanting to tell everybody everything, but we're going to wait a little bit longer, and it's going to be worth the wait, believe me. It's really a sensational book.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting it. Please give my best to Catherine, and make sure you get a copy of that to me just as soon as it's available. Our guest this evening is Liz McIntyre. She's written a book with Catherine Albrecht, and it's called Sky Chips. And what's the rest of it?
Spy Chips, with an S.
Right.
Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dr.
Good night. God bless. All right, fine. Well, that was, of course, a program. We've done programs on this before, but we're going to do programs on it again because you need to understand what's going on. There really is an occult hierarchy that rules the world. They really do have an agenda. If you doubt that there's an occult hierarchy, go to your computer and Google in the word occult hierarchy. And read down the page, you'll find that certain places there, they'll tell you about the plan. They have a plan. In fact, they refer to it with a capital P. And it's the age-old plan that's been around for 6,000 years. Of the beast, whose number is 666. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listening audience that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And, of course, if you believe that we are involved in a spiritual battle for the survival of Western civilization, the souls of men, and our society is under attack, that there is a conspiracy against God, And if you don't believe there's a conspiracy against God, get your concordance for your King James Bible and look it up, and you'll find the word conspiracy used over and over again, and they will tell you there's a conspiracy against God. And I figure it's good enough for the Holy Scriptures. It's good enough for me to believe and accept. If you believe that this is real, then we hope many of you will want to get our material and perhaps even decide to help Radio Liberty as we reach out across America 5 hours every day with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So, first of all, we hope that you'll go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. There you can listen to our radio programs 5 hours a day. On the Internet, either directly or indirectly, 3 hours a day. We'll be on my website, 2 hours a day, on other websites you can link to. And then you can listen to our archive programs. Please feel free to pull down our newsletters there and copy those newsletters and read the newsletters. Let me suggest the May and June 2005 newsletters, The Occult Hierarchy Part 1, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. What is the occult hierarchy? Why is it a group of supernatural beings that, of course, they say they're perfected human beings? I don't believe they are. I believe they're demonic beings from the other dimension. There is another dimension. Some of the most popular programs on television this fall will be The Medium and similar programs about people who can contact the other dimension. It's not imaginary. They talk about it in the scriptures. It's real. We've done many interviews with people who've been in contact with these demonic beings. And if you read the writings of the people who are associated with the occult hierarchy, they will tell you about these beings, demonic beings. They don't call them demonic at all. They call them the Ancients of Wisdom or the Masters of Wisdom or the Great White Brotherhood. But they are the leaders of the occult hierarchy, and they will tell you that they control the governments of the world. And why should we be surprised? If you read the scriptures, you'll find that when Jesus was on the Mount of Temptation, the devil said, if you'll simply bow down and worship me, I can give you all of the governments of the world. How could the devil possibly make that offer unless he controlled all of the governments of the world? Well, we're involved in a spiritual battle today. Most people don't understand what's going on. We hope that, of course, that many of you will want to get our material. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, read our newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. Ask that one specifically, and we'll be glad to send it to you free of charge. And then, of course, begin doing the research. Check our facts. Find out if it's true. If you want documentation, get in touch with us. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this spiritual battle for the survival of Western civilization. And of course, the souls of men. And so until tomorrow at the same time, and we'll be back with you again. Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.